This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Offices for money wires like Western Union have been closed in Afghanistan, adding to a serious financial crisis.
It's a matter of whether you will be able to get, like, food to eat. I think it is the most serious issue many people are facing.
I'm Marco Werman. Half a million Afghans may leave their country by year's end. In the European Union, leaders don't want a repeat of 2015.
We should not focus on what to do if we have a huge migration crisis. We should try to avoid a migration crisis.
We'll be hearing from the EU's top migration official, and China's zero-tolerance COVID policy puts global supply chains in a tailspin. As crazy as it sounds in September, the advice is do your holiday shopping now.
Me and my wife have been doing that for our son. We've been trying to grab stuff now.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. With the Taliban now in power in Afghanistan, it's raising all sorts of questions about how they will govern and whether the country will once again become a safe haven for terrorist groups like ISIS-K and Al-Qaeda. For a look at how these three groups are likely to interact in the new Afghanistan, we're joined by Ibrahim Bahis. He's a consultant with the International Crisis Group's Asia program, where he focuses on Afghanistan. Ibrahim, let's start with a question that we all seem to be asking. How different is the Taliban that's taken control in Afghanistan now from the one that ruled Afghanistan from the mid-90s until they were pushed out of power following the 9/11 attacks?
Well, like most political movements, it has learned, adapted, and changed over the years. Part of that lesson learning was that some of their restrictive policies in the 1990s turned them into a pariah state where other countries were unwilling to recognize it or provide it with any type of aid. Now, the Taliban is very cognizant of the fact that they need international recognition as well as at least investment, if not aid.
So what could all this mean for how the Taliban interact with terror groups operating in Afghanistan? Let's start with ISIS-K, the group that took responsibility for the bombings near the airport that killed the U.S. service members and many Afghans. Who are ISIS-K? What is their goal?
ISIS-K, or ISIS Khorasan Province, is the local branch of ISIS. And the moment they emerged, they declared the Taliban to be apostates and foreign spies that were working for the Pakistani intelligence agency. And a brutal war started between the two groups from the get-go. Over the years, due to being pressured not only by the Taliban, but also by the Afghan government and the US forces and NATO forces that were present in the country, ISK has lost all the little territory it did control at one point in time, but now it still retains significant numbers of sleeper cells in various urban centers, including Kabul, and they're able to activate them to take action such as they did in Kabul airport last week.
Right, and the Taliban have said they will not accept this kind of violence. I mean, how will the Taliban's rise to power affect how ISK operates now?
Well, even in 2015, when the group first emerged, the Taliban's deputy at the time sent a letter to Abu Bakr Baghdadi, who was the supposed caliph of ISIS, warning them that, look, Afghanistan's a no-go zone. You guys need to stay out of it. So I expect the Taliban will continue with that approach. Even recently, when the Taliban broke prisons, they released all their own prisoners. They also released common criminals, but they actually killed the former head of ISKP in Afghanistan, Abu Umar Khorasani, who was in one of the main prisons in Afghanistan. So I assume they will continue the same kind of repressive approach when it comes to ISKP.
And Ibrahim, how about Al-Qaeda? I mean, they did have support from the Taliban. Do Al-Qaeda still have a presence in Afghanistan?
the relationship between Al-Qaeda and Taliban was, I would argue, quite by accident, because the Taliban were a rural movement and Al-Qaeda was a Salafist movement. Al-Qaeda harbored global ambitions and the Taliban had always been more confined to national borders. But in the 1990s, as the international community shunned them and they imposed sanctions on them, the Taliban became more and more dependent on some of these militant groups, including Al-Qaeda. Right now, they seem to want to do things differently. But again, a lot will depend on how the international community interacts with the new Taliban.
The big concern, of course, is that Afghanistan once again becomes a safe haven for these groups to operate, but also to recruit people from outside the country and train them in Afghanistan. Based on what you know today, Ibrahim, how likely is that?
I would venture a guess and say that the prospects of such a scenario are unlikely for a number of reasons. First of all, Al-Qaeda, which is the biggest, rather globally focused organization, has decentralized to a large extent over the last 20 years. They're no longer that group which had a big presence in Afghanistan. Now their leaders are all over the world. Their number two is presently in Iran. Some of their strongest branches are present in Yemen, for example, in Northern Africa. And these are the top leaders of the organization. So the organization's a lot more decentralized, and it has had to adopt that posture because of the global war on terror and the pressure that the U.S. military has put on the organization. I see it unlikely that they would have incentive to refocus and rebuild in Afghanistan. Even if they did, I would say that the Taliban would be unlikely to welcome such a move. The Taliban have paid quite a heavy cost for their support for Al-Qaeda in the 1990s, and I don't think they will be willing to take such a decision very likely this time around.
Ibrahim Bahis is a consultant with the International Crisis Group's Asia program, where he focuses on Afghanistan. Ibrahim, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The new Texas law banning most abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy will have far-reaching impacts for many communities. For example, undocumented women in Texas seeking abortions. Their options were already narrow. They can't easily travel out of state because of Border Patrol checkpoints along the Texas-Mexico line. Nancy Cardenas-Pena knows a lot about the barriers these women face. She's the Texas director for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice. Nancy, what were the obstacles facing undocumented women in Texas seeking to end a pregnancy before this new law, SB8?
In areas like the Rio Grande Valley, we only have one clinic to meet the demand of an entire region. And that's millions of people trying to access services for this clinic. And so we also have internal immigration checkpoints 100 miles in that prevent people who are undocumented from seeking care outside of the state of Texas, outside of even that region where they currently live. So leaving the state for care, that's simply not an option.
Right. So the Border Patrol checkpoints already made it impractical for undocumented women to just go somewhere else for abortion services. For undocumented women, how else does this new law impact their reproductive health?
We did have previous legislation that basically made police officers de facto immigration agents. So we were already seeing a decrease of people who were undocumented attending regular appointments, regular checkups for preventative care, because these areas like the border were so over-militarized and so over-policed. And so we're definitely going to be seeing a continuation of that. It's not as simple as, you know, going to another state, even for other folks, right? Because the other states that are close to Texas have a very limited amount of abortion clinics. And such is the same for the Rio Grande Valley, a population and a region of so many people with just one abortion clinic.
And the Rio Grande Valley is where you do a lot of your work, right?
Absolutely. It's where I was born and raised, and this is where I will continue to do my work.
Would this law also impact women who live in Mexico near the Texas border and may rely on health services in Texas?
Yes. So there are a lot of very restrictive laws that Mexico has over abortion. And so the clinic here in the Rio Grande Valley was also meeting that demand of folks who were from Mexico and close to the border and could actually come into the United States.
What kind of calls have you been receiving from undocumented women seeking help? Like, what are the dilemmas they face and what kinds of questions do they have for you?
A lot of the questions that I get and calls and communications from folks is, what in the world are they going to do now? And it's not a very simple answer that I have, right? We have a huge dilemma, a catastrophic thing that's happening here in Texas, where a lot of folks need abortions past 6 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, that tough conversation, that does reflect the fact that ending a pregnancy is a complex personal decision. It's wrapped up in deeply ingrained cultural attitudes and religious beliefs.
when I hear people at the legislature use religion as an excuse for restricting abortion, that's just something that's not true. And we have a huge base of people from all different walks of life and different religious backgrounds that support people's access to abortion because it's a fundamental right, for one, and people know and understand that it's not ending abortion, it's just ending safe abortion.
Nancy, what kind of pushback does your group receive from within the Latino community for the work you do? How deep are the divides?
A lot of people have this conception that because we are a majority Latinx community and very religious, that we're going to receive a lot more pushback. But a lot of our members go to church. You know, we had recent local efforts try to pass an ordinance that copied SB 8 language, including the vigilante clause. And we had hundreds of people show up in opposition to it, much more than the other side. So I think people really need to expand their thinking and broaden their horizons when it comes to conflating religion and abortion.
Nancy Cardenas Peña, the Texas director for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Justice. Nancy, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
New headlines about the health impacts of coffee seem to come out every day. Researchers have studied its impact on everything from cancer to depression to diabetes. The latest headline, drinking coffee is associated with a slightly lower risk of heart disease and stroke. Those results were presented at the European Society of Cardiology last week, not yet published or peer-reviewed. For more on the current science of coffee and health, I'm joined by Harvard professor Sanjeev Chopra, who's been working on a new book, Coffee, the Magical Elixir. Professor, we should note that you were not involved in this recent research, but what do you make of this study?
This study looked at close to 500,000 subjects, and they look at genetics, they look at epidemiology, family history, do they have hypertension, do they smoke, do they have diabetes. And this study showed that amongst these 470,000 men and women, those who drank coffee had a significantly lower risk of stroke by 21%, fatal heart disease by 17%, and overall death by 12%.
It's not peer-reviewed, the study, as I said, but does the results surprise you?
They don't surprise me one bit. And you know, when you talk to your primary care physician, for whom I have the greatest respect, they have to know so much medicine, and you say, I heard coffee is good for you. Chances are they'll say, nah, these studies come and go, everything in moderation. In reality, the more coffee you drink, the better. That adds credibility to a study. If two cups are better than one, three better than two, four better than three, there's a dose-dependent effect, it adds credibility.
So just to be clear, the study said the amount that led to their conclusion of lower risk of stroke was half a cup of coffee to three cups. One interesting tidbit from this research is that the scientists put some 30,000 people in MRI machines to look at their hearts. What did they find?
They found that heart function was better. And this, again, adds credibility to the study. This is a unique, novel piece of this particular research. They actually looked at the functioning of the heart, and it worked better in those who drank coffee compared to those who don't drink coffee. Pretty impressive.
There's so much nutrition research, including the study we're talking about, that looks at an association, not causation, i.e. the causal link between whatever is being studied and subsequent health effects. How does that complicate our understanding of how our eating and drinking habits impact our health?
Yeah, so a number of my brilliant colleagues say it's not a randomized double-blind controlled study. I said, you can never do that with coffee. Can you take 100,000 people age 25 and say to 50,000 of them, hey guys, you're going to drink three cups of coffee a day. And the other 50,000, you're going to drink a placebo drink that looks like coffee and tastes like coffee. And we're going to follow you for 15 years. And then we'll see if there's a difference in health outcomes. That's just not a doable study. My only plea to people drinking coffee, I say I drink it black. If you want to put a little bit of milk or sugar, go ahead. I drink four cups, but I've had them by 4 p.m. If I drink regular coffee at 5 p.m., I'll probably be wired and up all night. So everyone metabolizes their differently. They're slow metabolizers. They're fast metabolizers. But all accrue the health benefits of coffee.
Thank you very much for the recommendations. I got to say, I feel better already. Sanjeev Chopra is a professor at Harvard Medical School and author of the forthcoming book, Coffee, the Magical Elixir. Great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Just ahead, we fill in the financial picture in Afghanistan for you. You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Afghanistan, in addition to its many challenges right now, is also one of the poorest countries in the world. Many people there rely on money from abroad. In 2020, Afghans received nearly $800 million from their relatives outside the country. That lifeline was broken when money transfer services stopped operating after the Taliban takeover. The World's Monica Campbell has this report.
Mohammed Nabi Mohammadi is trying to find a quiet place in his apartment in Fort Worth, Texas.
Let me just go to the other room.
Okay. He's 35 and has 5 kids, so it's rarely quiet. It's also rare that he's even home. He's a truck driver and is usually on the road, crisscrossing the U.S., hauling everything from flour and sugar to kitchen appliances. But wherever he is, he makes time every few weeks to pull over and wire cash to his mom in Afghanistan.
We have to send some money for my brother to take care of her. For the food, and sometimes we're paying the electricity, so water bill, but most of the time for the food, yes.
He usually sends $500 through Western Union. In 2013, Mohammadi left Afghanistan after working as an interpreter for the U.S. military. His brothers did that work, too, and also left. Now, just one brother still lives in Afghanistan, helping to take care of their mom. But at the moment, Mohammadi can't make those wire transfers.
Yeah, the situation is very, very bad, and it's impossible now because I cannot send money.
Western Union and MoneyGram suspended their services in Afghanistan after the Taliban took power. Western Union now says it will resume service, but that might be complicated because wire transfers depend on banks, and there's a massive run on banks in the country. Videos posted on social media show bank lines in Kabul stretching for blocks and blocks. There's also a cash shortage of the local currency. Banks have put limits on how much money people can withdraw.
It is the most serious issue many people are facing.
Haroom Rahimi is a law professor with the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul.
It's a matter of whether you will be able to get like food to eat. And you have to realize that more than half of the country was already below the poverty line. And people who received government salaries, 500,000 Afghans, that means 500,000 households, dependent on government salaries. Most of those people don't know if they have a job or not.
With the current situation, Mohammed Nabi Mohammadi in Texas is telling his brother in Afghanistan to just sell whatever he can.
We had one car. I told him that if sell that car, if somebody's buying it, sell anything you can if that's possible. Sell something that can get us some food until we figure out how we can help them.
I speak with a university student in Kabul. His last name is Han. He doesn't want to include his full name for security reasons because the Taliban have labeled his university as a training ground for infidels. The campus has faced deadly attacks multiple times. Han's also worried about cash. He says a relative in the U.S. was wiring money to his family right up until the Taliban takeover.
One of my cousins lives in Indiana.
An Amazon driver in Indiana.
He would send $1,000 per month.
Han says that cash helped more than 24 of his relatives pay for rent, food, and medicine. That assistance is even more critical now that many of Han's relatives have lost their jobs in Afghanistan.
They can't even support themselves. They can't even support us. I can't even support them. Many of my friends are the same.
The Taliban say they want people to get back to work, but it's not clear how soon the new government can start paying salaries. Han says he was hoping to tell his cousin in the U.S. to stop sending money, that he'd graduate from college in Afghanistan and start supporting his relatives himself.
If the things wouldn't have changed in Afghanistan, my goal was to serve my country, my people.
But things have changed. So for now, those hopes are on hold. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
Afghanistan has also lost much of its foreign aid and access to foreign currency reserves. This week, the new head of Afghanistan's central bank tried to reassure people that the Taliban want a fully functioning financial system. Alex Zerdin is watching closely. He served in Treasury Department at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul from 2018 to 2019. Alex, it looks now like Western Union will restart operations in Afghanistan. How significant is that?
It's an important step, but certainly not the only thing that's going to be required to get the Afghan economy up and running again. Remittances compose about 4% of GDP, about $800 million. And so that's an important indicator, but the larger issue is close to $8+ billion of international assistance annually that goes into Afghanistan that composes closer to 40% of GDP.
So looking at the country's banking system overall, let's start there. Even before the Taliban took over, what did it consist of?
It was quite anemic. So it's about 12 banks, about $4 billion in assets under management. That's a small fraction of the overall economy. So with the Taliban taking over the government, about a quarter of the banks, three of them, are state-owned. So there's a very live question of whether or not those three banks are automatically subject to OFAC and U.S. government sanctions, economic sanctions.
OFAC, that's Foreign Asset Control, right?
Yes, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which manages the U.S. sanctions program within the Treasury Department. Those three banks also were involved in providing a significant amount of payroll services for Afghan government employees and military officials. And now that the Afghan government is taken over by the Taliban, it raises other very challenging questions.
Let's talk about foreign currency reserves. How much is there and what access does the Taliban have to them?
There are about $9 billion of the Afghan government and the Afghan people's money that are in foreign reserves overseas. And the Treasury Department and partners took very swift action the Sunday that Kabul fell to deny the Taliban access to that money. So roughly $7 billion of that was parked in the United States, another $2 billion in other countries. That was the rainy day fund for the Afghan people and the Afghan government to provide import coverage in the event of a catastrophic emergency or the need to find other ways to pay for imports of basic goods and supplies like food. The issue is that that was never designed as a day-to-day spending account. Rather, it was the $8 to $9 billion of U.S. international assistance, which provided for salaries, which provided for government spending in Afghanistan to prop up the Afghan economy and the Afghan government. Those funds as well have been suspended along with IMF support through the International Monetary Fund.
So what would it take for the Taliban government to regain access to those reserves?
This is a very, very open question right now about if and when to open up these funds or restore these funds back to the Afghan government now controlled by the Taliban. But I think the Taliban's behavior will dictate a lot of future U.S. government action with respect to both humanitarian assistance and the future of these reserves.
What is keeping the Afghan economy going at this point?
Heroin. Unfortunately, I mean, if international aid is the largest source of funds in the country, the second largest was heroin. The Taliban has publicly committed to getting out of the heroin trade. But when it has been such a lucrative cash cow for the Taliban, I don't see how they can get rid of it. On the other side, those smuggling channels that get the heroin into markets in Europe and around the world and other parts of Asia can also be repurposed for smuggling other things like people. And that's a very big concern as well about a refugee crisis. Again, the Taliban has very few licit ways to raise revenue within the country without substantial international assistance. So they're going to have to get very creative very quickly about how to raise revenue.
Alex Zerdin served as Treasury Department Financial Attaché at the U.S. Embassy in Kabul from 2018 to 19. He's founder and principal of Capital Peak Strategies. Alex, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The World. Members of Indonesia's anti-corruption task force worked themselves out of jobs after taking a bizarre test designed for them to fail.
Agree or disagree, I have a bleak future. I live to atone for past sins. The divorcees were asked to explain why their marriages had ended.
And office gossip. Did you hear that it can actually be healthy? That's still coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The UN Refugee Agency is warning that 500,000 Afghans could leave their country by the end of the year. But where will people fleeing Afghanistan go to? In Europe, several countries are sending a clear message, don't come here. Many in Europe don't want a repeat of 2015 when more than 1 million asylum seekers, mostly Syrians, arrived on the continent. Ylva Johansson is the EU's top migration official, the Home Affairs Commissioner for the European Union. She's usually based in Brussels, but she's in Washington, where she's been meeting with U.S. officials. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Madam Commissioner, what is the plan EU ministers have come to this week for managing Afghan migration?
The most important to avoid a migration crisis is to avoid a humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. So we should not wait until a lot of people already had fled the country and maybe coming to the European borders. We need to help people, Afghans in Afghanistan. We need to continue with humanitarian aid. The European Commission has decided to quadruple the humanitarian aid to Afghanistan. We need also to put pressure on the new regime of the Taliban to respect at least the core of women's rights and fundamental rights. And it's important also to say that, of course, there are people that are under immediate threat right now in Afghanistan. Many of them have been evacuated by the Western countries, but there are still people that have been fighting for women's rights defenders, humanitarian rights defenders. This is important that we give international protection to these people through resettlement. And that needs to be a global response. So I spoke a few days ago to Secretary for Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, about this. The US will do resettlement. Canada will do resettlement. UK will do resettlement. And the European Union will do resettlement. And we have to work jointly on this.
So to that first part, what does it look like to provide humanitarian assistance inside Afghanistan right now to prevent that outward migration?
Well, United Nations is still on the ground working there, helping people, for example, the internally displaced people in Afghanistan to go back to their homes. And I think this is important. And I think we should make sure that they can continue their work. And also, the European Commission has decided to freeze the development aid to Afghanistan and to put pressure on the new regime. And we know that the Taliban are saying that they will act differently from the previous time. But we also know what they are capable of. So the important thing is how they will act.
Humanitarian assistance on the ground won't be like it was over the past 10 years, I would think.
Well, we don't really know yet, but probably it will not be as it has been, of course. But things are changing more or less hour by hour or day by day now. So we need, of course, to prepare for different kind of scenarios. But my point is that we should not focus on what to do if we have a huge migration crisis. We should try to avoid the migration crisis. That would be the first step. But then, of course, we need to prepare for different scenarios.
So if there is that migration crisis, talk to us next about the plan in the EU to support Afghanistan's neighbors to take in refugees, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Pakistan specifically.
Well, that's, of course, need to be developed together with those countries. And I don't think that is one size fits all. So it has to be tailored for each country. If there is a huge inflow of migrants coming to their country, then we need to be prepared to help.
What about details in this plan? How much would it cost? What are EU leaders ready to offer? And specifically, which of Afghanistan's neighbors could be receiving that money?
We are not at that point yet. We have not come up with that.
I read that there was a proposed budget of some $600 million.
That's not correct. I can't confirm that. It's not correct.
So it is a contingency plan, but it is one being considered by the EU. I mean, hypothetically, we've heard Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Pakistan mentioned. If that does turn out to be the case after negotiating with them, do you think countries like those can shoulder the responsibility for hundreds of thousands of Afghan refugees?
Well, let's hope that we will not have a humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. And of course, nobody wants a situation where a lot of people need to flee their country. So that's why we should not wait until that happens.
I'm speaking with Ylva Johansson, the EU's top migration official. There are several EU countries, including Greece, Croatia, and Hungary, which have been accused time and again of illegally pushing back asylum seekers trying to make it to the EU. Are you concerned about this happening to Afghans fleeing Taliban control?
Well, of course, when I hear reports on illegal pushbacks or violent pushbacks, of course, I'm concerned about that. And I'm convinced that member states, of course, they need to protect and are obliged to protect their external borders. But of course, they're also obliged to comply with fundamental rights in the Geneva Convention.
What about Afghans who are already in Europe? I mean, there are thousands of people who are waiting on their asylum applications as we speak. Will their cases be reviewed any differently now, given the situation in Afghanistan?
That could be. It's the responsibility for member states. And one issue that I raise is that member states actually differs a lot when it comes to the recognition rate of Afghans applying for asylum. And I call for a more Europeanized assessment of the asylum applications in general, but now, of course, for the Afghans.
From your position in the EU, is it your belief, Ms. Johansson, that the at-risk Afghans in a war that the U.S. started should first and foremost be an American responsibility?
Well, I think U.S. has a responsibility here, and this is what I've been discussing with Alejandro Mayorkas, and U.S. is ready to take part of this responsibility. But I think this is also, we call for a global response here, so we have to work together. It's important to have the right combination of giving protection to people in need of international protection, to really try to avoid the humanitarian crisis, but also, of course, to manage migration in an orderly way so that we will not repeat the situation from 2015.
EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson, thank you very much for speaking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Managing migration in an orderly way in Europe is not going to be easy. One reminder of that today in Poland. It's now implementing a state of emergency along its border with Belarus. That's because hundreds of migrants have been coming across that border in recent weeks. Right now, attention is focused on a group of 32 of them. They are mainly Afghans stuck in political limbo along the border between Poland and Belarus. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Every day for the past couple of weeks, Paulina Bovnik has been making the 45-mile round trip from her home in Bialystok in northeastern Poland to the border with Belarus. Bovnik is a doctor, and in her bag she carries medicines like antibiotics and anti-inflammatories that she hopes to give to the 32 migrants camped out at the border. But she tells me she usually gets stopped by Polish border police.
I asked the soldiers, can I give them the medicines? And they told me that this is not possible. They tell me I have to be 15 meters from this camp.
The migrants are living in 7 tents on the edge of a forest between Poland and Belarus. Conditions are pretty grim. A week ago, one Polish opposition lawmaker was cheered on by local activists when he attempted to bypass the soldiers and pass a bag of food and medicine to the migrants. But Polish guards chased him down and pinned him to the ground. In a video message sent to a Polish human rights group, one of the Afghans in the camp said most of the time they go hungry.
We don't have any food, we don't have any water, and the weather is very cold, especially in the night, and it's rainy.
The small piece of land that the migrants are stranded on is somewhat disputed territory. Poland claims it's in Belarus. The Belarusians say the migrants are on Polish soil, and the authorities from both sides say the group should apply for asylum in the other country.
So it's like border ping pong between Belarus and Poland right now.
Marta Gurkinska is a human rights lawyer based in Warsaw. She has visited the camp a number of times in the past month.
I've been working with refugees for 10 years now, and really it never happened to me to feel such helplessness, like being so close to people that need immediate assistance and not being able to help just because the government is saying that nobody's allowed to access the place where they're camping.
The political standoff isn't just playing out between Belarus and Poland. Migrants, most of them from Afghanistan and Iraq, have also tried to cross the border from Belarus into two other EU countries, Lithuania and Latvia. The European Union is accusing the Belarusian government of orchestrating the crisis by helping migrants travel to Belarus and then cross into neighbouring EU nations. Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki is laying the blame at the feet of the Belarusian President Aleksander Łukaszenka.
To właśnie próba wywołania wielkiego
Morawiecki says Belarus is trying to create another migrant crisis for Europe, and Poland will not tolerate this kind of provocation. He went on to announce plans to build a fence along Poland's entire border with Belarus. Warsaw-based political scientist Renata Mieńkowska-Norkiene says Poland's government is using the crisis to its own advantage.
The Polish government is interested in going on with this because it's a perfect opportunity to show off on the media and to use this narrative, anti-European narrative, anti-Russian narrative.
Mieńkowska-Norkiene says it also suits the government to play the nationalist card. Poland's ruling Law and Justice Party has used anti-immigrant rhetoric to win over voters in past elections. This week, the Polish Prime Minister raised the stakes further. He proposed a state of emergency along the country's border with Belarus. Human rights lawyer Marta Gorkinska says this is a big mistake.
We fear that what may happen is that our access to the border zones will be limited and that we will not be able to monitor the situation to document what's happening there.
Dr. Paulina Bovnik says cutting off access to the border would be a disaster for the migrants.
I think it will be a tragedy for all these people because we bring them hope. Every day they tell us, thank you that you are here. We are waiting to be with you.
This afternoon, the Polish president agreed to pass the state of emergency. It's the first time Poland has made such a declaration since communist times. Activists and journalists have been warned that they must leave the border area by midnight tonight or face arrest. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
We know that nature can positively impact mental health, but now doctors in Brussels are trying out the opposite approach. Instead of telling people to head outdoors, they're sending people indoors to museums.
Art can at least try to help mental trouble and mental difficulties.
Sophie Monk is with Brussels Culture and Tourism Office. Doctors in Brussels will soon be able to prescribe museum visits to patients at Brugman Hospital, one of the largest in the Belgian capital. That announcement came this week. Inspiration came from Quebec, Canada, where doctors can prescribe patients up to 50 museum visits per year. In Brussels, the program is working with 5 different city-run museums, providing free entry to those with a prescription, including a fashion museum, a center for contemporary art, and...
We work with the sewer museum.
Yep, a sewer museum.
This one is a good example because sewer museum, it's like playful, you know, and it looks like something different. So it's like an experiment. It's not ordinary.
Definitely not ordinary, but I can see how it would shift your focus. The city of Brussels will be testing out these museum prescriptions for the next 3 months. They'll then hand over the results to researchers with a goal of expanding the program to private museums next year. That is one script you don't need to take to the pharmacy. Sometimes you can be too good at your job. That seems to be the case with the government agency in Indonesia that was in charge of rooting out corruption. Many of its top investigators who went after corrupt politicians and the business elite are now out of a job. This month, the commission is essentially being dismantled. Here to explain is Jason Palmer, host of The Intelligence, a podcast from our partners at The Economist. Welcome.
Hi, Marco.
Set the stage for us, Jason. How bad is corruption in Indonesia?
Well, last year, Transparency International rated it more corrupt than Brazil or India. But you might argue it's better than it was. If you go back to Suharto, the general, the dictator who ran the country for 31 years, you'll find a kleptocracy. Tens of billions of dollars of government money went missing into officials' pockets. And when Suharto was ousted in 1998, there were real efforts to decentralize the government. Power was devolved to the regions, and there was this big push to clean up corruption. I spoke with Charlie McCann, our Southeast Asia correspondent, about an agency that was set up to do just that.
The Corruption Eradication Commission, or KPK as it's known, was set up in 2003 to tackle graft. And it's investigated a bunch of very high-profile people, and it's very good at what it does. So these investigations have resulted in the convictions of over 900 people, among them cabinet ministers and even the father-in-law of a former president. In a way, the KPK has been too successful. It's created for itself a ton of enemies. The agency has been targeted by police officers, parliamentarians, and now even by Jokowi.
Jokowi, that would be Joko Widodo, the current Indonesian president.
Yeah, and it seems that the KPK's investigations hit a little too close to home. So Jokowi's government is now folding that once independent agency into the civil service, which doesn't on the surface sound too troubling, but Charlie told us about the catch.
As part of that transition, all staff have had to take entrance tests. But this exam wasn't the standard issue exam. It seems it was designed to ensure that many of the KPK employees would fail. Many of them did, and dozens of KPK employees, including some of the agency's best investigators, have been sacked as a result of this process.
Jason, what did Charlie mean there when she says not standard issue, this exam?
Well, listen to some of the questions. Agree or disagree? I have a bleak future. I live to atone for past sins. Agree or disagree? Homosexuals should be given corporal punishment. Some female employees said they were asked about their sexual desires. Divorcees were asked to explain why their marriages had ended. The questions were traps designed to make those KPK employees look compromised in some way.
Wow. Do we know how much the president's fingerprints are on this?
Well, what I can say is that it fits a troubling pattern. Jokowi was elected in 2014 on a platform of reform, of getting rid of the rot. He promised to protect civil liberties, to promote better governance. But within a year, he was whittling away at civil rights, disbanding civil society groups, suppressing opposition parties, scooping back powers from the regions. And even as he does all of this, he remains really popular among Indonesian voters. He was, in fact, re-elected on something like that same reform agenda.
Surveys show that Indonesians really like democracy. In the last presidential election, 80% of registered voters went out to vote. Most Indonesians see democracy not as a system for promoting liberal values, but as a system for delivering economic benefits. And that's what Jokowi is doing. He has brought economic benefits to Indonesians. They are getting richer. As long as that keeps on happening, a lot of Indonesians won't mind having their political rights stripped from them.
Wow. It really shows how hard the fight against corruption is really everywhere around the globe. That was Charlie McCann, the Economist Southeast Asia reporter. And speaking with us was Jason Palmer, host of The Intelligence. You can hear more of their conversation wherever you download your podcasts. Jason, thank you very much for sharing the story.
Always a pleasure, Marco.
China has managed to keep its COVID numbers relatively low compared to other countries. It reports just over 100,000 confirmed COVID cases in total in the pandemic, compared to 39 million here in the U.S. One reason for China's success is its zero-tolerance policy. Travel into the country is restricted and COVID cases are isolated through contact tracing and quarantines. The policy also includes shutting down shipping and airport terminals for weeks at a time for just one case of COVID. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai reports on how that could impact this year's holiday shopping season.
At a factory in Ningbo, China, forklifts are unloading raw materials from a shipping container. The factory makes all kinds of plastic stuff, storage containers, toys, Christmas lights and decorations, and sends them in other shipping containers to dollar stores across the U.S.
Wow!
Last year, the factory owner, Duan Li, invited me for a tour to see how the sausage gets made. He showed me his whole operation, the huge bags of plastic pellets he imports from Malaysia, the molding machines pumping out products 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the workers packing boxes on the factory floor. I called him up the other day to hear how the pandemic is affecting his business.
I've got at least 200 shipping containers worth of plastic storage boxes just sitting in a warehouse, but I can't get the shipping containers to put them in. The prices used to be low, but now a shipping container costs me $20,000, and the wait for a container is 2 to 3 months.
Every year around this time, factories in China are finishing up orders and sending them across the world to arrive in time for the holiday shopping season. But this year, Duan says there might not be enough time.
Every day I bid on a shipping container. I'll just have to pay more for the containers so I can get them on the ships. It's only going to get more expensive as we get closer to Christmas, and the American shoppers are going to have to pay higher prices.
Duan's not the only one facing shipping problems in China, especially when a single COVID case can shut down a terminal for weeks. Jared Ward is the Chief Business Development Officer at Yusen Logistics East Asia office. And it's his job to help clients have a plan in place for when things go wrong.
You know, when that kind of ambiguity enters the supply chain, it just reverberates back through the network like a bullwhip. what that does is just creates a lot of uncertainty and, at the end of the day, higher cost.
The irony is that business is booming. It's just getting harder and harder to get stuff to the people that order it. Ward says companies need to have backup plans and be ready to move fast.
First thing is make sure that you're aware of what those options are, and then be prepared to make very fast decisions based on fluid, ambiguous information. And that takes a lot of guts.
Terminal closures have become one of the biggest headaches. Sal Mercogliano is a history professor and former merchant mariner. He has a whole YouTube channel devoted to global supply chain issues. And every day, he checks a marine traffic app to see what's happening at different ports around the world. He says when the Ningbo port was partially shut down last month, some shipping companies diverted ships to other ports.
Which means now that if you were expecting your load of containers coming out of Ningbo, it may not be there, or it may be, instead of getting it next month, it may be getting it in January, which if you're loaded with Christmas goods, you're in trouble.
They're still trying to work through that bottleneck. Thanksgiving, Halloween, and Christmas, there will be empty shelves. They just can't get there in time.
Michael Crotty runs a home textiles trading company in Shanghai. Crotty says he's short 25 to 30 containers because of the backup. But he says no matter what pressure other countries put on Beijing, the government is not likely to back down on its strict COVID policies.
China's zero policy is not going away. Whether the world likes it or they don't like it, it's worked for them. They've managed to control the pandemic since the early stages. And no matter what kind of pressure is applied from the West, their decision will be whatever they think is best for their population.
Even if terminal closures are gumming up supply chains and hurting business owners, many people in China think it's the right thing to do. That includes Kurt Huang, who runs a fruit importing business.
事实证明，中国政府做的都是对的，而且呢是全世界范围唯一做的。
The past year has shown the government is taking the right approach, he says, and they'll continue this policy. It's what's made it possible for us to lead normal lives and for our economy to continue, he says. So with no foreseeable end in sight, I ask Sal Mercogliano, the professor, what American shoppers should be doing.
Do your Christmas shopping now. Me and my wife have been doing that for our son. We've been trying to grab stuff now. I think you're going to need to really be that flexible in what you want to get.
So I guess let the holiday shopping season begin. For the world, I'm Rebecca Kanther in Shanghai.
If you're like me, you grew up learning that gossip was a bad thing. You shouldn't talk about people behind their backs. But research on gossip in the workplace actually finds that it can be a positive. Shannon Taylor, an expert on this, says that might be especially true as return-to-work plans remain in limbo for lots of Americans.
People don't know when they're going back, how they're going back, how their work has changed.
Taylor teaches management at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. He says that when people don't know what's going on, gossip can actually be a big help.
It's not to harm people or to damage their reputations. The most commonly cited reason is to gather and validate information.
Research studies in Europe and the Americas indicate that hearing gossip about colleagues can help people reestablish the culture of the workplace.
In the sense that it will help them connect emotionally, it will help them get in touch with what has happened, where they are at now.
Elena Martinescu at the Free University of Amsterdam there, she's been leading research into gossip for 7 years.
It does help you navigate your social environment. It does help you bond with others. It does help you make better decisions about who to work with or not.
And it tends to moderate bad behavior in the workplace, a sort of peer pressure. Shannon Taylor points out that no one wants to be the target of gossip.
So if somebody's doing something they shouldn't, other people will gossip about that. And it will quickly spread, and you'll get a reputation as somebody who's not behaving in the group's best interest, and that should serve as a deterrent.
Of course, it's not all good news. Negative gossip about colleagues can help improve their behavior. It can also leave them feeling hurt. Elena Martinescu's research backs that up.
So when you hear negative gossip that is about yourself, you feel, I don't belong with these people, they don't understand who I am, so why should I help them?
Which leads to employees who are the subject of gossip doing the bare minimum and nothing more.
If I see one of my colleagues in need of help, I'm going to be less likely to offer help.
So what do these researchers do about gossip where they work?
I think I'm more likely to think twice.
I'm trying to make it sort of a habit to say nice things about people when they're not around.
Always good advice. And for all of you, you wonderful and attentive listeners, that's where we leave you today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. I'll be off for the next couple of days. Carol Hills will be with you as your host. Enjoy your long weekend if you have one. And thank you for listening. From PR.